Well, it's Friday the 13th. I hope that doesn't mean anything for today's podcast. Welcome, everybody, to the Planet Poetry Podcast, the home of poetry in Wales. Now then, when we were last here, we had another guest, Gemma King. Matthew, sadly, she didn't quite win the Dylan Thomas Prize.
She just missed out, didn't she?
It was a shame, but I think it stands her in good stead for the future to be recognised in such a prestigious award.
It's a very public recognition of an achievement so far, isn't it?
But today we've got a bona fide award winner.
We do.
2010 T.S. Eliot Award and the Wales Book of the Year Award. Congratulations on those. It's 3 years too late, Philip, but thank you very, very much for coming in. I should introduce him properly. We've got Philip Gross in the office today, very, very kindly joined us. You were doing a reading last night. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that? How did that go?
Indeed. It was at the Arts Centre in Aberystwyth. We had a very engaged audience. I thought a very resonant audience. It's a feeling that I like and recognise in an audience when they bring their own love of language. And about half the people there were writers anyway. And also bring their own life stories with them. I think some of them knew that it would be a reading which was very much around the subject of old age, because this is a book which is largely based on my father's last year. It's called Later, and half of the book is literally later. It's the afterwards. But I was very aware that what was happening in the room as I read was there were probably about twice as many people as you could see in that room, because so many people had their aged fathers or mothers or uncles with them, and quite a lot of them spoke about them afterwards and spoke not exactly about what I'd said, but exactly what I would have wished, was that, you know, that put me in mind of thinking about my father or whoever in that same way. And I thought, that's lovely. That's the best thing that I could have wished out of a reading like that, that actually people don't end up thinking about me and my writing at all, but end up thinking about their own lives in a slightly different, heightened way.
I think it's true. It was a moving event, actually. Sometimes poetry readings can be primarily about the poet who's there standing in front of you, but this was a reading that made you think on in family ways.
So let's talk a little bit more about Later, then.
Yes.
It's your latest title. Mm-hmm. So why don't you tell us a little bit about its formation?
Well, I've said that this is largely written in the last year of my very elderly father's life, and in the year after it, so it can hardly help taking on a before and after hinged feeling. In the middle of it, I think it's possibly the most honest page in the book, which is the one that has no words on it. And I've not advertised that fact except now, but I hope someone somewhere in the reading of the book will notice fact.
I didn't. That's totally new to me.
You didn't notice the space in the middle.
Didn't think anything of it.
Oh, right,
that's,
okay.
That could be reflection on me, but yeah. Matthew, did
well,
you?
Well, I noticed it was there. I noticed that it provided a breakpoint within the book. I was interested to know perhaps your thinking on that breakpoint. Mm. You've somewhat explained that already.
I think it's probably unwritable to write about the fact of the instant of death. I think the poems before it get very close, probably just hours away from the end. I wasn't with him at the actual exact moment of dying, which happened in the middle of a long night. and was probably not observable from the outside anyway. But that feeling of going as far towards that unsayable, not unspeakable, but perhaps unsayable thing as you can, and then giving it a tactful and respectful space. One of the things we spoke about last night with the audience at the end was how much you build a poem not just out of the words in it, but words and spaces, words and silence. And I've got lots of respect for the well-judged and resonant silences you might be able to build in a poem, which are both respectful of the thing and also invite your readers in, bring what they naturally would in that silence.
So the blank page on page 44, for you, yeah, that's not just a section breaker. That's no. That's almost a poetic moment, yeah, in itself.
Could you call it a poem?
Yes. That was the private thought I had in my mind. I also thought that by advertising that fact in any way would spoil what I wanted it privately to be doing. So I know that the act of writing is meant to be exchanging meanings and experiences with your readers, but I just wanted to leave that one there for readers to either find and make for themselves or not. And also just let it be what it is in its own right, just as I would hope I would do with a poem once it's finished, or rather once it's finished enough that it's left home and it must be in the hands of readers after that.
That notion of being finished enough is fascinating. Can you expand on that a little? Because that suggests something about your composition process and your sense of what it means to conclude a poem.
At risk of sounding fey and mystical, which I'm not, I do think it's at least a good myth that we can live with as writers, that poems have their own lives and they will evolve in ways that they want, that we might not know in advance or even afterwards. I think it's a useful metaphor that what you're writing is a child which will need to leave home and live its own life at some point. There is always that balance of nature and nurture in it, as with a child. You can try hard and do your very best as a parent, but you also, once in a while, you look it in its eyes and you think there is something in there which will unfold. You know, I can harm it, I can encourage it, but basically what I need in the end is that it will be itself. And, you know, it will certainly be flawed, because I have been flawed as a parent stroke writer at the moment it leaves home, but I might not know which are the flaws and which are the gifts anyway, and they might turn out to be actually the flip sides of the same thing. And I must just trust the world and readers with it. It's beyond me.
It's a very honest response, and
yes.
I find it fascinating. We discussed when we set up this podcast what we were hoping to achieve, and hearing the responses of poets, the relationships between themselves and their own poems, strikes me as such a varied and eclectic field. I thought they would be along the same theme, but we're getting so many different responses. I think we're going to have to revisit this again.
Of course, yes. But I'm not surprised in some ways.
I found it slightly unexpected what I find myself saying. And so might some readers, because on the face of it, I do write about my own experience or my family's experience quite a lot. And I'm not one of those writers who thinks that I must leave myself outside. But at the same time, I'm not interested in it in myself. Yeah, so I think that material I've got and other things will work through it. And I might be writing about my own life, or I might be writing about the Severn Estuary, or I might be writing about stones or blocks of concrete.
Yes.
And what matters is actually the attention that you bring to whatever it is, whether it's called me or whether it's called you or whether it's called it.
Yes, we've been talking about the I as well, the poet, the narrator, mm-hmm. who's talking, who's reading.
Yes.
This collection of poetry asks a lot of questions of that.
In the sense of it seems a record of an individual's experience.
Yeah, quite. But after hearing what Philip just had to say, then you don't have to revisit that notion, but it's just another layer that you take with you into this collection when you visit it for the next time.
And of course, it's also about a stage at the end of a very old man's life, when in lots of ways he was losing those things which we see the boundaries of who we are, of ourselves. He was losing his language and later losing his memories and, you know, his losing his story of himself. So being alongside anyone who's at that stage of life, which after all we will face more and more often, you know, there are ways in which our loved ones will be lost before they actually die, and we don't have ways of well understanding that yet, but all of them leave us asking, okay, where are you? Where is the person I've known when they aren't in their words, when they aren't in their language, when they aren't in their own understanding of themselves anymore? Are they somewhere outside beyond that veil of words, or do we disperse?
That brings to mind something you said last night after the reading about the importance of exile to the collection as a whole. And while we were talking before we started recording, you also mentioned the importance of home to the collection as a whole. And those two things seem to talk to one another, quite importantly, exile and home. And I wonder if you could respond to that.
I was quite startled when I looked at the final proofs of this book to find out that the word home came back again and again. You know, if I'd have thought in advance, I would have just looked over that manuscript and I'd have done find, and it would have come up with about 30 instances of the word home. Whether I would have then edited any of those out, I think not. It just seemed so obvious that that was not so much the point on which poems would end, but it would always be a bearing. This is partly because my father's experience was as an Estonian wartime refugee, so the issue of home being elsewhere, that I was brought up with his just occasional but charged references to home. And I would suddenly realise that when he said home, he didn't mean the house in which we lived with each other. So, but there's also the issue that there was a stage after Estonian independence when he could easily have gone back, at least on a visit, and he chose not to. You know, I do quote his actual words: "What could I have done by going back except see that it was gone?"
That's from the poem Home, 1990, isn't it?
Yes.
I wonder, would you read it for us?
I certainly would.
Just as a quick note to everybody listening as well, if you heard some rumblings, something else has arrived in the office. It's the rain.
Yes. Home, 1990. One day in that year, and so quietly that not the closest of us guessed, the history of Europe changed. I don't mean votes and constitutions, old flags in the attic half a century, now tentative petals again. But one day, one night, out beyond the house lights, beside one of those fires you attend and chivy patiently to sleep. So many leaves that year, as if they were pouring in on quite another wind. It may be some recording angel, veiled or given momentary body by a furl of smoke, might have seen the moment when, thin blue letter in hand, saying, "Come, you can come home now." You knew. The place you'd dreamed of going back to, with a family, three horses, a path through the fields, was nowhere. "What could I do by going," you said later, "except see it was gone." Blue paper crinkling in the fire. Estonia was safe, here, inside you.
There's quite a bit of Estonia, I think, in this collection. Mm. Is that because of your relationship with that country, or because it represents aspects of your father?
I was brought up with it as an absence. It had a very particular shape and a feeling and a resonance, but I didn't know about his wartime history. He spoke about it really very little. There are many things I found out only well on in my adult life. It was a resonant space. It was clearly a charged space, and maybe one of the things early on that gave me a feeling for the way that not only words can be full of meaning and resonance, but the absence of words might be as well. I have been there now 4 or 5 times over the last 15 years. I've worked there. I've got friends there. My initial reaction when I first landed there was, "Oh, but it's just a country." Yes, and of course it is, you know. I was quite moved, actually, after that first reaction, when I found that I didn't sort of get off the aircraft and fall down and embrace the tarmac or whatever you're meant to do. And also I heard this language going on in the street around me, and I was waiting for the moment when something deep in the genes would click and I would understand it. No, it didn't. But what I found was a small, battered country which was getting back on its feet and doing quite decently, with an absence of vengefulness after 50 years of occupation, you know, getting on reasonably well with the fact it would now be a very mixed ethnic population in a way that couldn't be altered, you know, and needed to be embraced gradually. So I actually ended up quite admiring them. There is certainly something about an Estonian way of holding memory, of holding feelings. They are famously contained and reticent people. I think that isn't only one of those national cliches. It's a fact that there are different emotional languages in the way that there are spoken languages. And this is a very northern kind of language, which at first I couldn't read at all. I would be with people who would not be easing and pleasing me forwards with the kind of that we do for each other so much. And at first I was faintly chilled, and I thought, really, this is going down a bomb, isn't it? And then suddenly I clicked and I realized, no, these people are listening to me really well. They're giving me this space to an extent that was almost scary. I thought, I'm not used to being listened to this well. Am I up to it? So, you know, that's something about resonating space and resonating quietness as well. I think I understood that because in adult life I've been a Quaker. I think if I hadn't had that other sounding board of what a Quaker silence is, you know, it's not about absence of speech, it's about listening, then that made sense.
It seems that you are also listening to Estonia in some of your poems here. Barn Music and White Night both yes. seem to respond to elements of Estonian culture themselves.
Certainly, though, those are about me having been there and met people and worked with artists and musicians there and knowing other writers there. What happens at the end of the book in White Night, I've actually never been in Estonia on Midsummer's Eve. And every Estonian says, I don't understand what it feels like being Estonian unless I have been there on that evening and stayed up all night right. and understood that sense of north. So I've got that north. And if there's, I think the word north turns up in the book almost as often as the word home. Not that I think it actually is my home, you know, there's, I will not go and live there, but it's a bearing. I think one thing about home in this book is it doesn't mean the place one will go back to.
Yes, that seems very clear from the poem you just read. At the end, Estonia was safe here inside you,
yes.
you write, and that I found that very striking. I wonder if I could move you on to talk about general approaches to poetic composition. Would that be okay?
You can ask what you like. I might not have impressively crisp answers
That's
for you
fine.
Because I don't find that writing is an impressively crisp-edged process at all. In fact, I rather distrust it when it is. Those moments when I realise, oh, I know what I'm up to now. I thought, oh, well, in that case, it probably isn't worth doing.
Well, that bears immediately on one of the questions I wanted to ask, because you talked last night at the reading. You used the phrase, in advising newer poets how to pursue writing, you used the phrase, find out what you do and then understand it. And I wanted to ask whether you'd made a conscious decision to pursue a particular kind of aesthetic or a particular set of aesthetics in your poetry, or has it been more a case of finding what you do, more organically, perhaps?
I think overall it's been about finding. I can think of one or two odd moments in the past where I felt I'd consciously been freed from something I felt I'd been bound by in the past. I think in my earlier books, for about the first 10 years of my writing life, most people would have spotted me as a very fastidious writer who would do draft after draft, and I was sometimes thought of as being a formalist, not that that's a phrase I like at all, but people who said that were picking up something about that need to crispen up the edges. And there was one moment when I was standing in a gallery in St. Ives and looking at Japanese pots, and I'd been watching the process by which they'd been made. They were fairly plain and each one had one spiral mark on it. I thought, those marks are elegant. I see how those were made. They weren't painted on afterwards. They were marked while the pot was still turning on the wheel. And I thought, now, if I had been doing that as the kind of writer I've been, I would have stopped the wheel again and again and done the next bit and turned it back and corrected the last bit, and it would look rubbish. And there was a kind of looseness and life about those marks which had been made by probably waiting for that moment and then going with it and letting the mark make itself with whatever momentum there was in the wheel and the clay and the hand and the glaze. And I thought, okay, I've just got a little jolt like electricity out of that image. I need not make a theory out of that, but there was just something that my heart leapt at the feeling that you could work like that. I would like to work more like that. And I think I've done more of that since, which means sometimes I've waited longer and then written faster and been more inclined to trust what occurs, having faith that it probably has some reason of its own that I might not understand yet.
Well, you have that unerring ability of bringing moments of clarity to those vague creative situations that you just mentioned. Is that something you seek, or is that something that finds you?
Do you mean finding moments of clarity?
Yeah, just the jolt, you know, of witnessing that act and then finding a sort of a truth from it, which is hard to define, but with your own words, you somehow managed to really sort of boil it down to a clear image for all our listeners.
I like the word clear and clarity and images of shedding light. It was only very recently, in fact, it was in the talk after doing a reading a few weeks back, that I was asked what I thought that writing a poem about an experience like my family's, like my father's, could actually offer, you know, frankly, whether it would help. And just thinking out loud, I was thinking, well, clearly it doesn't work a cure. Does it make things better? Does it soothe feelings? It might not soothe feelings. It might contain feelings. No, that sounds as though it's putting feelings out of sight. And then I realized there was an old Quaker phrase, which we use quite often, that you might take an experience and hold it in the light. And you can see what kind of resonance that would have in a Quaker meeting. And it isn't about praying for, it isn't about even willing any outcome for it. I've got a very tactile feeling in my hands, which you can't see on radio, of how you would hold something up in the light. So maybe that's what's happening in a poem. You are holding things, but holding them in the light.
That's extremely interesting, especially in the context of something you've said, which perhaps seems to, for most people, would intuitively seem to push in the other direction, where you've said you've tried to disrupt linearity. Mm. Most people associate linearity with a certain clarity, and the disruption of it possibly as a lack of clarity. But you have talked about disrupting linearity as part of what you do in the poetic process. Can you talk a little further about that?
Yes. I can, at worst, be a very dogged kind of thinker who will follow things through step by step. I distrust that kind of thought process which keeps its eyes on its feet as closely as that, because it probably isn't noticing what's going on in the corner of its eyes. So I think what I was after in that thought about linearity is, you know, I still want us to think as lucidly as we can. I certainly wouldn't make that an excuse for willed vagueness.
Yes.
Because, you know, that often can just be smokescreen. I think we have heads and hearts and skin and senses, and we should be using all of those with each other. And I want our minds to think as well as they can, but without limiting the other things that our senses and instincts pick out of the air. So what I was offering last night was a wish to hold an experience in a cloud that probably has kind of gravity and flow patterns of its own that might be subtler than the ones that I could lay out in a straight line of thoughts and logic.
That's fascinating. And it also seems to speak to something formally that happens in your poetry, because you are not a poet who is scared of parenthetical interjection. In fact, there's quite a few moments where the thought seems to go in eddies and flows, and you break and you shift. And it's fascinating because that actually suggests to me a real confidence in your ability to keep a reader with you, waiting for the for one throw of thought to re-pick up again.
I realise it's asking quite a lot. I especially realise that when I'm reading things out loud. You know, I've actually consciously had the thought, good heavens, I'm just about to ask these people to wait for 5.5 lines before I finish this sentence, before you even reach the main verb. How can I expect you to stay with me? Quick, make desperate eye contact with them. Reassure them that they aren't lost. But I think it is being honest. Mm. That is how I think, whether it's a fault or not. I'm often quite aware of there being more than one thought that I could think at that moment, and really wanting to hold the other one in the margin, in the place that it won't vanish in the air. And of course, often it does. It just vanishes like smoke. But sometimes what happens in the brackets is saying, hold that thought. Now, that is also true. The thought of the sentence is thinking onwards, but in parallel with that, it's sometimes it's like a kind of vertical line that goes out of the horizontal thought.
Does your poetry, let me start that again, because this is quite a difficult question. Your poems seem to be almost experiments. By that I mean you have a notion, you go through that notion via, well, I suppose, the power of poetry, and it's almost when you're holding these things in the light, it's almost when you say that, it's like it could also mean under a microscope of sorts. Is that a process, or am I bringing that out of nothing?
I'm very happy working with the word experiment. Yes, in fact, that's one that cropped up last night at the reading as well. If it isn't a thought experiment, it probably isn't a poem. But I also have notebooks. I have kind of word sketchbooks in which there's lots of this happening, not all of which I would recognise afterwards as being a poem. So some of these things are picked almost whole out of that notebook. Others are kind of enticed out of the cloud into more clarity than they have yet in the notebook. And some of it is mulch.
Well, I think a lot of our listeners very interested in the process. And Matthew, you always seem to want to tease out the processes that different people go through to get something on a page.
I'm fascinated with how different poets write in different ways and how they get to the work on the page.
So how much of the process, how much of the science in the process do you recognize in yourself?
I've paused there because I'm wondering what to make of the word science. But of course, we have used the word experiment.
I guess that's what led me on.
Which leads us there. I mean, I certainly recognise craft. I also rather love good science. You know, I'm not a person who sees science and art being opposing forces. And when I say good science, I mean eternal curiosity. And I'm never assuming that you've reached the right answer. Everything is hypothesis. Everything is the best finding we've got so far. You know, if it's certain, then it's bad science, like it would be probably a bad poem. So I will certainly own the word science to that extent. I just realised saying that this father of mine was a science teacher. So yes. I mean, maybe not doing that kind of speculative experimental science. What I got from him was observation. So putting things under a microscope is probably not that far from holding things in the light.
I'm personally always looking for quite firm meanings in words, because my father is he's a linguist, but he very much led from a science approach, you know, syntax, sort of the lexical values of words rather than the more open meanings.
Mm.
And so sometimes I like for somebody to tell me this word actually means this.
Well, there's one word in this collection that was brand new to me. And I wondered, Philip, if you could maybe read the poem Concerned and then talk a little about the word that was brand new to me, which is glossa.
Glossa, ah, yes. Well, this is, I believe, Portuguese or Spanish. It is a consciously difficult verse form, but I also was pleased when I found this almost accidentally, because it's about a very active form of reading that writers can do for each other. The form is that you find four lines that you like by a writer who you admire, and it's almost as though you can converse with them by getting literally inside their own words. Those four lines of theirs become the final lines of four ode form verses in a set rhymed form. So everything you write happens within their four lines. So it is both a writing and a reading. I have one in this book which was getting inside and expanding that oldest of all English lyrics that went, "Western wind, when wilt thou blow, the small rains down can rain. Christ, if my love was in my arms, and I in my bed again."
Where did you find this? How did you come across
the form, you mean?
Build a glossa. What led you to this word?
That form. Frankly, because I was teaching on a writing course at the Arvon House in Yorkshire, and people wanted to be set a really demanding verse form.
so you found one, all right.
And so I said, villanelle, peanuts. Sestina, been there, done that. Now, have you got anything really difficult for us, Philip? So I went and found this literally off the internet. You know, it was arbitrary. And
you went on a little adventure.
And the reason this poem is in this book later was this was just a couple of weeks after my father's death. I was there in a fairly spaced out state of mind anyway. Kind of part of me was not there, but also part of me was very much in focus because of that. And I explained how this glossa works, and people said, yeah, but we really need an example, and I couldn't find a good one. So I thought I'd better just go and fake one up. So I that night, by dead of night, I thought, you know, it doesn't matter what I write. It just needs to do these rhymes, or in this case half rhymes, but it needs to enact that form. And by the paradox, by the kind of irony by which these things get you, because my brain was completely occupied doing something mechanical, I thought pure artifice. When I look back at what it had become afterwards, it was about my father. It was the most kind of, it was the kind of writing about him that I had no intention of doing at that stage, and would have been daunted and almost not felt it would have been right to try and do that at that moment. But through the fabric of the artifice and the game it made itself.
Would you be willing to read it?
I will.
Thank you.
Glossa on Western Wind. Where were we? Something shifted in the night, as if the house resettled, ground easing itself with a groan. If not the house, then maybe weather. The wind still held its not quite a note, rather a space into which a note might go, live and not matter, like the sound of sand that travellers' tales call singing. Infinite distance, but close, like that nobody's song, O western wine, when will thou blow? Where are you now, who couldn't hold a tune, or the country of singers you left? You'd no choice about that, any more than for me, my tone-deaf smudges on the air that no advice, no scolding at the age of 10 could school. No choice but play it again. For us both, that shared halt in the voice, on the phone or off guard. It's my turn to hear its crackle on the window pane. The small rains down can rain. That's not your language or your kind of song, or not in public. Tears, idle tears, give me patience, you'd say. Give tongue to rage, grief, or repining. They take liberties and homes and lives. One must be strong. You were. Outliving friends and false alarms, heart pills and hospital calls for 30 years, eventually alone, where you seemed to belong, not free from, but at home with harm. Christ, if my love was in my arms. Though who or what your love might signify, buried in languages she couldn't speak, my mother soon learned not to pry. A wind from somewhere colder, it might leak through the cracks in your voice, as now in mine. Leave it to music, then to silence, to explain what words would make too rigid and too weak. The wind has shifted, so we redefine our four square walls by what they can't contain. You gone, and I in my bed again.
You have a real lyrical quality to your performance. It's almost theatric. Also, I'm not sure, has anybody mentioned this to you, but when you're reading your poetry, you have a slight smile. Do you enjoy reading your own poetry?
When it works, being inside it, then it is one of life's gifts. You know, when it works, it holds me rather than me it. And that's, you know, I don't feel it is my gift. It feels like a gift to me.
It's a very personal response.
And rather moving, actually.
Yeah, quite. Well, I suppose we've better come to the end of this actually fabulously enjoyable podcast. It's been a real pleasure having you here, Philip. Thank you very, very much.
Yes, thank you.
Thank you. And it's ended up as the kind of interview we talked about in advance, when I have ended up saying things out loud that I certainly hadn't planned in advance and will probably be startled when I hear them broadcast afterwards.
That's Matthew's fault. You don't look into his eyes too long. I'd also like to thank Helen Pendry for doing the production today. I'd like to thank Blood Axe as well for sending us copies of the book. And if you are interested in the book, that's the best place to go and pick it up. Bloodaxe.com.co.uk. One never really knows. Well, I feel vaguely enlightened.
Yes, I have to say I do too. It's been genuinely, genuinely interesting. Really, as you say, enlightening. I feel I've learned quite a lot. But isn't that the point of the podcast?
That's the point.
We want to learn from our poets. We want to learn how they do what they do, what they think about what they do. It's all part of why we're doing this thing.
Last thanks go to our listeners. Thank you very much for tuning in. Please look out for our next podcast. Until then, Paul Boyle, diolch.